Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 63, How to Use a Mouse. This episode of Futures in Biotech is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/biotech.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there going to be the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy or something?
Ballpark, 10 years.
It's potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun is the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. Today, our guest has greatly enhanced our ability to functionally dissect the human genome, which has in turn initiated a new 21st century frontier in medicine. He's a distinguished professor of human genetics and biology at the University of Utah and investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. He's won numerous prizes, the National Medal of Science, the National Science Foundation, the Kyoto Prize, the Wolf Prize in Medicine, the Gardner Foundation International Award, the 2001 Albert Lasker Award, and finally, the 2007 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for his discoveries of principles for introducing specific gene modifications in mice by the use of embryonic stem cells. Welcome to the show, Dr. Mario Capecchi.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You know, there's a lot. You've had a very, very interesting life and career. If you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a little bit about your life, because I believe it's a very motivating story. And in your autobiography at NobelPrize.org, you prefaced that in 1996, as a Kyoto Prize laureate, you were asked to write an autobiographical sketch of your early upbringing. Their hope was to uncover potential influences or experience that may have been key to fostering a creative spirit within us. And in your own case, you saw that despite the complete absence of an early nurturing environment, the intrinsic drive to make a difference in our world is not easily quenched, and that given the opportunity, early handicaps can be overcome and dreams achieved. What did you mean by that?
I think what's important is giving everybody an opportunity, that is in terms of education, in terms of being able to reach for whatever they seek in terms of what they're dreaming about. So given that opportunity, then I think any child will prosper.
You did have some difficulties in early life, and you overcame them. Would you like to talk a little bit about that and how it influenced your life? Because we could also talk about your early career at Harvard and go from there.
Sure. I mean, I think the early influences are difficult to assess as to, you know, whether they were positive or negative. I mean, I think during that period of time, I was learning things that weren't being taught in school. So I wasn't getting a formal education. But on the other hand, I was experiencing life and seeing what worked and what didn't work. And the main thing that was important at that time was simply survival, that is, being able to obtain food and shelter. And so those are the things that preoccupied me, and I think it trained me to be patient.
I suppose that it did indeed force you to learn how to ask a question and find a solution yourself.
You're completely self-reliant. And so in that sense, you do seek out your own solutions and see what works, and how the pattern. I mean, a child doesn't question their environment. They simply are put into it, and then they interact with that environment and see what works and what doesn't work. And I think that's actually a good life experience in terms of any discipline, whether it be it science or any other discipline.
Well, you made the best of it, which is really quite amazing, and I think is an inspiration to all. Do you believe that it's more important to want to make a difference in the world or to have sheer curiosity? Or is it a combination?
I think it's a combination. I mean, I think curiosity is what keeps you asking questions and seeing what's known and what isn't known, and then probing the unknown. I think the other is important in terms of resilience and keeping on going. So I think it's both aspects are important.
Wow. Because, you take on gigantic challenges, and I'm wondering, you know, how do you motivate yourself at that level to keep going, considering how difficult science can be?
Well, I think, again, it's always, you know, it's always probing the unknown. I mean, the question I always ask myself, you know, where are we right now and where do we want to be and how do we approach getting there? That is the technology available to be able to address the questions we want to address? And if not, develop the technology or see if somebody else is developing that technology. So it's always a quest. So you're always, you know, probing forward, thinking about the future and seeing, you know, how you interact with it. And it's exciting. I mean, you know, one of the things about science is that it's never static. It's always changing. So you're all, the questions I'm addressing today are very different from what I was questioning 5 years from now will be very different from what I'm going to be asking 5 years from now. Well, so 5 years back and 5 years from now.
I'm smiling because, you know, some people tend to say, well, that technology is not there, I'll invent it. And some people say that nobody's even thought about this technology and I'll invent it. And yeah. I somewhat believe that you're in the category that's willing to take risks at jumping as far as you can ahead in terms of technology and bring it to fruition.
I think that's one of the hallmarks of our lab is that we do always seek, you know, what isn't available. And that often does require developing new technologies and seeing, you know, how would you even go about it? I mean, right now we're starting a project that will probably take 20 years to develop because we don't have the technology, but we know what we want to do. We simply don't know how to do it.
That's great. And you have a plan B project and plan C projects, I suppose, that are more conservative.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the secret. You do have to take that chance, right?
Oh, yeah. You have to
buy the lottery ticket.
That's right. No, it's always a big risk. And the bigger the jump, the bigger the risk, because you literally have no idea how long it'll take you and where, you know, where you go. But you do have ways of assessing whether you're going in the right direction, at least.
Well, yeah, sometimes little eureka moments help you get confidence, yep. I suppose. Yep. So I'd like to talk a little bit about your early career at Harvard. And what was the environment like and how did it influence how you do science?
I mean, I have two careers at Harvard. I mean, one as a student, and I was in Jim Watson's laboratory of Watson and Crick. And that was very exciting because that was just at the beginning of molecular biology. And you always had a fusion, essentially, of physicists, chemists, biologists, geneticists, all coming together to start addressing questions in a new way. And so that was extremely exciting. And then I had a second career as a faculty member at the medical school. And again, you know, that was a very good scientists there, but they weren't going after what I was trying to seek. And therefore, after a while, I left and came to Utah.
And how did the environment for a scientist change from going from Harvard Medical School to Utah? The frontier? It's a natural frontier.
Well, there was, the reason I came here is one is the ability to then participate in building a new department. And that has the excitement that you can bring together the kind of people that you want to work with. So that was one aspect of it. The other aspect was that I often want to work on long-term projects, ones that may take 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And that's a very difficult environment to – Harvard was a difficult environment to pursue that simply because every day you're asked what's new. And pretty soon you start working on projects that a few days will start generating new knowledge. And so you get short-term gratification, but not the ability or the luxury to be able to work on long-term projects. And I think that's what I had at Utah, and I still have. And so I can now still pursue things that I, you know, will take a long time to pursue.
Oh, it's a beautiful balance. And I think we should all take stock in this, that not to necessarily go for the 2-year project, but aim high and aim far. Right.
No, and I think because a lot of questions that are of interest will actually take a while to develop. It's simply it's not going to come through, you know, in a couple of years.
Let me ask you, let's start with one of your long-term development project, which was the development of the technologies to introduce genes into mouse ES cells, right? No, embryonic stem cells for the audience. So these, you take mice embryo cells and you can genetically modify them thanks to Dr. Capecchi. And this allows you to map out the functional genome, basically. Could you tell us how you really got started in that?
We came at that from two perspectives. The first was really studying recombination, homologous recombination. At the time, people knew about homologous recombination, but they thought it was having to do with essentially sex. That is, how you distribute pieces of DNA from one parent, from the two parents, and give a child a distribution of those pieces of DNA. So what we were finding is that actually all cells, that is somatic cells, skin cells, whatever, also have this machinery, and therefore we could take advantage of this machinery then to start utilizing it to change gene in a specific way. So that's how we got into that project. And then the other aspect was simply from what's called somatic cell genetics, where people were starting to play with cells and see whether could you actually generate mutations in cells culture itself. So those two combined and then allowed us to think about, well, what if we're able to actually change gene in a mouse? That would have a tremendous impact simply because up to that time, all the mutations that have been gathered in mice were simply serendipities. That is, coat color mutants show up because we can obviously see different coat colors. But the things we were interested in, you know, how does the brain work or how does development occur, those kind of mutations weren't coming through.
So is that sort of like, so homologous recombination is where you through recombinant DNA technology, you go put parts of the functional gene into your construct, and then you throw it into the genome, but very precisely at the place to knock out that gene or disrupt it or replace it. Mm-hmm. Versus the randomness, I suppose, of exposing mice to mutagens and trying to find one that has a change in phenotype in biology, right? So that was a huge transition.
It's a big transition. And then the other thing that it allows us to do is to make very design changes. For example, to bring in a gene from another organism, say one that turns the cells blue or turns the cells fluorescently green and so on, into the middle of a gene, those kind of changes could never occur in nature. So we can do things that aren't conceivable in nature that will still allow us then to visualize what's happening and thereby infer what the function of that gene is. So the level of sophistication by homologous recombinations is tremendous. I mean, it allows you to do things that would never happen in nature.
I can remember in my early career in plant biotechnology, we were at a point where we were pulling out genes because we could, but we couldn't really figure out how the plants weren't amenable to molecular biology at that stage. And we thought, well, let's mutagenize and then hopefully maybe clone a gene that's related to some kind of super tall corn or salt-resistant wheat. But really, the ability to go in and knock the genes out and break them apart is now an approach, the only approach I would ever take. Because it saves you the time of screening millions and millions and millions of organisms that are slow growing.
That's correct. And also things that are difficult to, for example, if you want a recessive mutation where every two mutant genes, you have to do a lot of backcrossing. And if you work with complex organisms like a mouse, that takes a lot of time and resources. So here we can just inactivate both copies of a gene and then see what happens.
And there's a consortium now to And what stage are they at in terms of knocking out every?
I mean, my guess is right now probably around 2/3 of the genes have been inactivated. But we also want to construct, you know, much more complex. I mean, not only do you want to knock out the gene, but you want to be able to knock it out in a particular cell type at a particular time in development or post-development. You want to bring in reporter genes that allow you to see things. So the level of sophistication is, you know, continually increasing. Right now, we normally work with one gene at a time. In the near future, we'll be working with, you know, half a dozen genes at a time, and each of them controlling them under separate different temporal controls and spatial controls.
We're going to talk a little bit about some of the models and maybe talk a little bit about the genes that you're working on as well, and how I suppose these technologies can be applied to create human genetic models. But before we do so, I'd like to get this out of the way. I have to do an audible spot. So audible.com is a leading provider of audiobooks, and they have 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature. Fiction, nonfiction, they even have science. And for the listeners of Futures in Biotech, they can go over to audible.com/biotech and download a free book if they sign up to an account. But the account is free and they have a 2-week trial. And if they like it, they get to keep the free book. If they don't, they can cancel the account, not pay a thing, and keep the free book. And what we normally do is we pick a book. And what I thought would be fun was picking DNA, The Secrets of Life, or The Secret of Life by James Watson, your mentor. And it's with Andrew Berry and narrated by Dan Cashman. And this book is, I find it's a great way to get a picture of where molecular biology is. I mean, James Watson is a true authority and has played such an important role in developing the policy that has, you know, many countries have taken on. Including the Human Genome Project. And this is a personal account and of modern genetic research and the technological and ethical challenges that it unleashes. So I'd urge you to go over and download DNA, The Secret of Life by James Watson with Andrew Berry, and download it for free. As I said, you can cancel your account and keep the free book if you like, or if you don't like Audible. But I'm sure you will. So head over to audible.com/biotech. We thank them for the support of Futures in Biotech. All right, so we're talking about manipulating single genes at a time, manipulating multiple genes to create mice such that we can understand a scientific problem. Would you like, maybe you could talk about, I could ask you about the Hox genes and how you using your technologies to understand them. And maybe tell us what they are. What are Hox genes?
Sure. Hox genes are essentially a set of genes. There are 39 of them in all mammals, which are involved in specifying where along your body axis you make certain things, like organs. You make your liver at a particular place, your kidneys are in a different position, your arms are at the right place, and so on. So this allows you essentially to give positional value to your whole embryo and make the onlogger, which then will make the different tissues that are appropriate for that region. And that's the normal function of Hox genes. But recently, we've actually gotten involved in a completely unexpected function of Hox genes, and that is actually in behavior. That is, we inactivated a Hox gene, which is called HoxB8, and gives rise to a very unexpected behavior that's very similar to humans with the OCD and OC spectrum disorder called trichotillomania, where these patients actually pull out their hair compulsively.
Well, so that paper came out in May.
Just recently, yeah.
Just 5 weeks ago. So we'll put the link to the paper in our show notes. So can you tell us how you figured that one out, and how the project sort of rolled around? Because you've done some. There was an interesting. It was a really interesting approach.
I mean, the initial approach was, I always say we, and we is always the royal we, meaning graduate students, postdocs in the lab. And this work was started by a graduate student called Joey Greer. And what she did was simply to take movies of these mice. And because mice are mostly active at nighttime, she used infrared cameras and simply took movies 24 hours a day and then simply asked, what is the mouse doing? And what she found was that everything in terms of eating, drinking, running around the cage, building nests, walking upside down in the cage, you name it, everything was the same as controls except grooming. And that is, these mice were spending twice as much time grooming as normal mice. But in addition to it being simply more grooming, the grooming became pathological. That is, they continued to groom until they actually started to remove the hair. And then at those same sites, they pretty soon they got lesions. And this is common, for example, with OCD patients. What they do is they wash their hands all the time, and then pretty soon they actually have lesions on their hands because they're not getting the feedback to tell them that their hands are clean. And so then this mouse has that same behavior pattern.
This is knocked out for HOXB8?
This is HOXB8. Yeah, it's one of the HOX genes. Run gene. And that gives you a very specific behavioral output. And so that was unexpected. You know, why should a HOX gene be involved in behavior? So then the next step was taken by another graduate student, Xiaohua Chen, in the lab. And then what he found, we could see the gene was expressed functioning in the brain, but the level was extremely low. And so what we do is to put it under, put HOXB8, a reporter gene, for example, GFP, green fluorescent protein. So wherever the gene functions, then those cells turn green. And so that allows us to have a robust assay.
The dip switch that turns it on.
Right.
So you have a little bit of a lag. We have about a half second lag. So you put a little dip switch that turns the gene on and replace the gene with, so that you know when it's supposed to be turned on, and you put a green fluorescent protein.
Right. And so then those cells turn green. And so then we look in the brain and see, you know, what cells are green. And this was an enormous surprise. And that is microglia. Now, microglia are immune cells of the brain. And there are two sources of microglia. There's one that is there very early in the embryo before you actually make blood vessels. And then there's a second that is actually after birth where it's coming from the bone marrow. It's the same as the blood cells, essentially. And then a particular set of bone marrow cells, these are called monocytes, can actually infiltrate the brain, get across the bone marrow barrier, and then occupy the brain. And it's those cells that were turning green. So now we display the question saying, now how is an immune cell that normally scavenges dead cells in the brain now involving maintaining eccentric behavior, that is making sure that this behavior didn't go awry and give you rise to pathological behavior. So now we're in that process. That is, how does actually a microglia control behavior? And now the prediction of that experiment—it's
crazy.
It's really crazy. And the prediction was very strong, and that is, we should be able to cure that behavior simply by a bone marrow transplant. You irradiate the mouse, you wipe out its bone marrow, now reimplant it with new bone marrow from a normal mouse, and does that cure that behavior? And the answer is yes, it works. And that was a real surprise. So, and further, we can do the opposite experiment. That is, we can take a mutant bone marrow, put it into a normal mouse, and now that mouse has the pathological behavior. So we can do it either way. And so now, you know, we have strong evidence that microglia are controlling behavior. And now that opens up a whole new chapter in terms of microbial biology.
That's an amazing story of science where you knock out one gene, you don't know what it does.
Right.
And if you knock out enough of them, you're going to find really, really interesting events. And then the biology, that the cascade of biology is enormous.
Yeah. And you never expect...
I guess, go ahead.
And the other thing I should point out is that actually, not only is it important for OCD or OC spectrum disorders like trichotillomania, but it turns out that most neuropsychiatric disorders, whether you're talking about monopolar, bipolar depression, autism, schizophrenia, OCD, OC spectrum disorder, even Alzheimer's disease, all of those have been known to have an association with the immune system. That is, patients that have monopolar depression often also have defects in their immune system. But it wasn't clear why. Are you depressed and therefore your immune system isn't working well? Or is your immune system not working well and therefore you're at higher risk of having depression? Okay, cause and effect wasn't clear, and even how those two were connected was not clear. And so now we're providing, saying here microglia can affect, which are immune systems, can affect essentially behavior. And these cells are coming from the bone marrow. We can actually light up, we can make bone marrow that's green and then ask, do those cells get into the brain and then become microglia in the brain? And they do.
So you've got this cell disrupted in one gene, HOXB8, and it's an immune cell that's in the brain that derives from bone marrow. I'm just seeing if I understand correctly. And that, while we don't understand necessarily the function of the disruption of the gene, you've now illustrated that a changed microglia, which is an immune cell, can have an enormous control over the behavior of that individual.
That's right. That's right.
I suppose that subtle changes in various related genes down maybe in the cascade of the HOX8 or whatnot might, if it's further down, might modify different behaviors.
That's right. I mean, and I think, we may just be at the tip of the iceberg in terms of how many behaviors are being controlled through microglia. So that's one aspect of it. And then the other aspect is simply how is it doing it? And one can imagine, again, a lot of different scenarios, and they're not mutually exclusive. An example is one thing that immune cells all do is make cytokines. That's how they communicate with each other. So they may be making cytokines that are actually affecting neural circuits, which in turn are controlling this behavior. So that's one possibility, but that's just one among many.
So this may be a very, very strong oversimplification, but somebody who's washing their hands or grooming is trying to get rid of potential pathogens.
That's right.
And so they have a defective microglia in their brain, so they're out grooming to remove any potential. They're scared of getting infected. Mm-hmm. Is that like... Is that it? Is it as simple as that? That
it could,
the brain's
that could be
ability
a connection.
To get rid of pathogens?
Yeah. No, I mean, in a sense, one is removal of pathogens is extremely important. That is our defense against pathogens. If we look at the part of our genome which has been evolving most rapidly, it always has to do with the immune system because that's our biggest threat in terms of our life existence. And as our populations go up, then we're going to have actually more and more infections as opposed to less and less, simply because it's a function of how dense people are living, under those conditions that then spread those diseases. So I think the defense against pathogens is extremely is enormous. Okay, if we don't do it, we die. On the other hand, why not then connect your behavior to also that? I mean, so, wouldn't it make sense if you have a behavior that gets rid of pathogens to connect it along with the immune system that actually kills those pathogens once they break that barrier? So that's one way of sort of seeing why there is a connection essentially between immune system controlling behavior, which would be consistent again with getting rid of pathogens. That's simply a way of looking at evolution to say, why hook these things up together?
Would it be, so you grew your mice in sterile environments. Would it be possible that even though they're grown in a sterile environment, that there's a potential pathogen that the HOXB8 microglia couldn't get? And so that you've now are somewhat mildly infected with a non-lethal pathogen in the brain, and then that is triggering the behavioral pattern?
Behavior. No, I mean, I think, how you get to pathological, you have a behavior that's doing something good. Then all of a sudden now it becomes pathological. And the question is, why is that happening? And I think, again, thinking along the lines you've just indicated, maybe a way of looking at that aspect of it. Either that the pathological behavior under certain circumstances actually has some advantage, or alternatively, simply the whole system has gone awry. I mean, one of the things we're thinking about is that One of the things that's common in terms of OCD, it's common actually with respect to a lot of other neuropsychiatric disorder, is anxiety. You know, fear, anxiety, simply getting your adrenaline system going up too heavily. So I think there may also be a connection. That is, that that you're trying to control all of these different types of behaviors by reducing essentially the level of anxiety, which may also be important for example, people to be able to communicate with each other. I mean, initially we were all running around pretty much in isolation, and now all of a sudden we're starting to get together, and we have to break down those anxiety levels in order to be able to communicate and interact with each other. So again, that may be an important selective advantage of this type of behavior.
It's amazing. So, I guess when you read the paper, you're nobody would expect. You know, and that's what makes the science fun. So nobody would expect that a potential cure for OCD would be a bone marrow transplant.
That's right.
And I guess you could do a partial one. You wouldn't have to get rid of the bone marrow. You just have to pull some out, modify it.
Right.
You know.
Well, I mean, I think that's one possibility. And right now, bone marrow transplants are fairly risky. That is, approximately 1% of patients actually die of just the procedure. As people start doing more and more bone marrow transplants, I'm sure, you know, people will develop the technologies which will allow them not to be as high a risk. So that's one aspect. But the other aspect simply is that we know a lot more about our immune system than we know about how our brain works and how drugs affect essentially neuropsychiatric disorders. And what this says is pay attention to the immune deficiency, because you know a lot more about them and you can control them much more effectively.
Well, there's some really interesting work being done on HIV and the bone marrow, where they don't genetically modify. I think it's a CCR5 gene that you want to disrupt to become resistant to HIV. And what they did is, I think they lowered the viral titer in patients where they did a partial bone marrow transplant, which I think would be much less risky than an entire bone marrow transplant.
Sure.
Leukemia.
When you knock it all out, if it doesn't reimplant efficiently, then you're in deep trouble. So that, you know, if a partial one would be much have lower risk. That's true. And then again, I think you know what that also makes is quantitative differences. And many diseases, you know, you have to have a threshold value. And if you can get below that threshold value, then it's no longer a threat. And that's true of HIV, for example.
How about culturing some ES cells, or not embryonic stem cells? It's just adult stem cells to form microglia with HOX-B8, and then give a patient a monthly dose of their own cells.
Of its own cells. No, and I think those kind of things, I think people will be looking in the future. I mean, that's one aspect of essentially, you know, all of the therapies that have to do with stem cell therapy. I mean, there and many, many diseases, I think, will be profited by that technology.
What I think is really fun is that your science, the science we're talking about coming out of your lab, is right at the pivotal point that breaks open a whole field.
That's right. No, research. That's when science is really exciting, is when all of a sudden you see things that, you know, juxtaposed that previously you never thought about, that there were relationships among, you know, disparate systems. And I think what this says is, you know, one is we're extremely complex, and we always knew that. But the level of complexity, the more we get into it, is the greater and greater, because many of these systems are interacting in unexpected ways.
Would you like to talk a little bit about, what is your next project on the HOX-B8? How are you going to approach it?
I think there's one aspect of microglia that people are just beginning to appreciate. They sort of look like neurons. They have these enormous extensions, and they're putting them out, and they take them in, and they're waving around in space. The cell body itself is standing still, but these arms, these sort of tentacles, are sweeping the whole system. And in fact, we can calculate that within about an hour's period, the microglia, these pseudopods, are actually covering the entire brain surface. Okay, so they're moving around all the time, and then all of a sudden they stop. And then they stay there, and they stay there, and they stay there. Your question is, you know, what's happening? And if when you look, what you find is that these protrusions are actually now in intimate contact with the synapse, the connection between neurons that are communicating with each other. And they're really there, tightly bound to it. And the question is, why are they doing that? And, you know, and if you're there and you're really tightly holding on to it, are you actually regulating it? And so this would be an exciting area where all of a sudden, you know, microglia, which are simply supposed to be there to gobble up dead cells, are mm-hmm. now actually in contact with synapses and modulating that circuit. So that's one area we want to go into, is to try to define, is there actually electrical contacts between essentially a microglia and neurons, and can they interact with specific circuitries? I mean, for example, in OCD, we know the circuit that's involved in terms of generating repetitive behavior. It's a fairly well-defined circuit. In fact, it's known as the OCD circuit. And so we know where to look. And now the question is, are microglia a part of that system?
I'm digesting this because this is amazing. So microglia might actually be functional pseudoneurons that are changing processing in the human brain.
And you know, and there's a lot of data now that indicate, I mean, if we look at our brain, it's actually about 10% neurons and 90% glia. And there are all types of glia, microglia being one of them, and astroglia being another, and so on. And there is more and more evidence that these glia are actually participating in many, many functions in the brain, and it's not just neurons that are doing all the communication.
That's amazing. Well, that's a lot of work. I'm thinking about how to go about, you know, looking at the electrophysiology of microglia's interactions with neurons. Like co-cultures, are you going to grow them together and sort of break it down that way?
What the problem is that, for example, if you stick a needle in your brain, okay, what happens is you're going to be killing some cells as that needle's going in. And then what happens is the microglia now change their shape and then become more amoeboid-like and actually travel to that disruption and then start trying to fix the problem, that is, gobble up dead cells, pick up debris, and so on. So any perturbation you do to the brain now activates these microglia to do something else. Okay. So what we want to be able to do it, I mean, it's very difficult, is study the microglia in the brain without perturbing the brain. And that utilizes things like two-photon microscopy and so on, which allows us to penetrate the brain but not disrupt the brain.
That's amazing. Two-photon microscopy, for the audience, is a three-dimensional microscopy that allows you to see deep into the brain of a mouse, well, fairly deep, I suppose, yep. and see if you're using genetics. And I'd refer people back to our episodes. We did two episodes with Marty Chalfie on how to use GFP. Mm-hmm. It's a green fluorescent protein. You can put it behind a dip switch of the gene you're studying. And then you can actually see the functional aspects and where the protein is being made live, that so you can knock it out, turns green, and now you're. Do you expect the microglia for the HOXB8 genes to be different, like not knowing where to go and what part of the brain, that's, and maybe now there's a...
Yeah, that's the first thing to ask is simply, is their behavior now different? Are they, for example, still waving their arms around but not making contacts with synapses anymore? You know, what is different about it? Do they respond? I mean, one question we would like to answer is, if we now tweak the neurons, does this now excite the microglia? Okay, and are they now excited and they're starting to put out their protrusions to that area? So is there a relationship it's between neural activity and how the microglia are interacting with that activity? So there are, you know, many, many types of experiments one can do, and it'll occupy us for a while.
How about a registry for HOXB8, this one gene? Do patients with OCD have various mutations that make it partially functional, completely disrupted, or, you know, are the initiation site mutations?
No, I mean, it turns out, for example, with trichotillomania, and OCD separately affects about 3% of all populations that have been tested, and many populations have been tested. So it seems to be broadly affect many, many different people and types of people. So one thing we can ask, if there's that many, you know, are there HOXB8 mutations, for example, in patients that have OCD or trichotillomania itself? And if so, what are these types of mutations that are affecting it? So that's one aspect of the study that we can do. And I think the other thing that's interesting is that people are doing a lot of bone marrow transplants. I mean, around 200,000 have been done. Mm-hmm. And the question is, you know, is there any data as to what the effects of those bone marrow transplants have been? Wow. And among those, among that population, there has to be people that have OCD, have, you know, monopolar depression and so on. And can one start gleaning some story, essentially, from all of these bone marrow transplants that have already been done, if people have kept, you know, very good notes as essentially what the outcomes have been? So, you know, so we're trying to see whether we can get a hold of that type of data and see whether retrospectively we can find anything out that's already been available.
Much in the same way that the patient that was had a bone marrow transplant became resistant to HIV, which is incredible. If you could see a bone marrow transplant patient have differential behavior, cured of psychological disorders because of their microglia, and then everybody's going to go down and read paper one by. I don't have the name of the first author. I was looking always at the senior author here.
Xiaohua Chen was the he's a graduate student. He was the primary author in that paper.
What a brilliant project. That's amazing. A lot of science, and there's going to be a lot of careers spent trying to figure out the function of microglia now.
I hope a lot of other scientists get into it and start asking those questions also. I mean, what's fun is when if you can draw other people to also work on that problem.
I guess that's your talent. So by studying these HOX genes, how many genes have you disrupted in mice and seen, changes in organ function, development, and behavior? This is the first behavioral one?
This is the first behavioral one. We've inactivated all 39, and we're starting all of them. And they all have multiple effects. I mean, they're really, you know, each HOX gene is controlling hundreds of other genes. They're essentially orchestrators. They turn genes on and they turn genes off and so on. And they're doing many, many different things. So it's a very complicated study, and that'll occupy us forever because it's endless in a sense. The deeper you go, the greater your understanding. They're involved in, for example, motor neurons, which control all of your movements. What specifies that certain motor neurons go into your arm and other ones go into your legs and particular muscles in the arm and so on. There are over 50 different muscles in the arm that have to be controlled. All of this is being done under the control of HOX genes.
Amazing. So you have to really, when you're approaching the science, you have to have clearly an open mind and one willing to crack the books open. To really understand the human body.
It often takes you in directions that you never anticipated. I mean, you know, when we started, for example, there were no atlases for the mouse brain. Okay, and so what we did was use human atlases and simply looked at see where are the different parts in the human brain, and then we could find them essentially where they are in the mouse. Now there are many, many atlases in the mouse brain and rat brain and so on. But, all of a sudden, if you need some information, you have to find wherever you can find it.
Absolutely. You want to not study the part this I want cheese part of the brain, but you want the the one that's similar to human. Do you have an MRI in the lab? Are you studying blood flow and ion movement in the brain using MRI?
I mean, we don't have one in the lab, but we do have one at the university, which is fairly high sophisticated one that allows us to get down to the resolution that we required for mice. I mean, one of the things we would be excited about is, you know, imaging in the brain is becoming much, much more sophisticated. And in a very few years, you'll be able to actually do imaging in the brain and say this person actually has schizophrenia and that this type of schizophrenia or has monopolar depression and so on. Simply from looking at the imaging, you'll be able to infer essentially disease, and you can use that as a diagnostic tool. But what's exciting for us is, you know, we have a very difficult time figuring out what the mouse is thinking about. If it has a headache, you know, that's a major problem for us. But if we could use human imaging to interpret what the mouse is thinking about, then all of a sudden, you know, we'll be essentially at a new level, sure. Essentially, sophistication of what we can do in the mouse.
Well, Eric Kandel presented at the neuroscience meeting in Chicago last year these intelligent mice, or he called them intelligent. Maybe they could help you. Maybe we could push them over the limit and they can answer your questions while they're in the MRI.
That's all right.
Maybe best go with humans. Sorry, but I digress. Would you like to talk about, we have a few more minutes. Would you like to talk about the new mouse model for, I can't pronounce it, alveolar rhabdomyosarcoma?
Yeah, we're putting a big effort into sarcomas. And one question you might ask is, you know, why sarcomas? In humans, carcinomas are much more prevalent than sarcomas are. But sarcomas affect a very important segment of the population, and that is children and young adults. Most cancers affect older people, and the older you get, the higher the probability you'll get this or that type of carcinoma. This affects, they're extremely aggressive, and therefore affect essentially very young population. And being aggressive, for example, in many of these sarcomas, the probability right now is that after first presentation, 80% of those children are likely to die in 5 years. Okay, so that's really aggressive. And so it's also because they're not as common, drug companies aren't as interested. Okay, so there's a niche. And so that's what we've been going into, and alveolar rhabdomyosarcoma, synovial sarcoma, all sorts of sarcomas are now we're modeling them. And the big advantage is we know how they begin. Okay, if you're a modeler, you want to start at the beginning rather than the middle or the end. Okay, normally when you get a tumor, you have the end state, and you have a whole series of steps that have occurred, 6 or 7 that are important for that particular tumor. But you don't know the order, you don't know whether it's always A, B, C, D, or is there different combinations that can give rise to the same tumor and so on. But in this case, one is it's simpler and it's very rapid, and therefore I think we'd be able to identify all the different steps very early in these models. So that's why we're excited about them, and we're modeling them, and we've got, I mean, the other nice thing about science now is that the criteria of saying, is this a good model for humans, is getting better and better. We can look at thousands of genes in there, expression patterns, and say they're the same as humans or not. And rather than simply saying, you know, well, this gene is the same, at least maybe it's the same type of tumor. Okay, so the criteria is improved, and therefore we can evaluate that tumor in the mouse and say it really is human sarcoma. In this case, alveolar rhabdomyosarcoma or synovial sarcoma or whatever. And what starts them is two chromosomes breaking and then rejoining. And so the information content is pretty much the same, but at the joint where you put now two different chromosomes together, all of a sudden you've created a new gene, which is half of one gene and half of another gene. Okay, and it's that thing that actually is starting the sarcomas. So we have a way of identifying that gene and then initiating the tumor in the right step, and then asking with respect to thousands of genes, is it the same as the human tumor? And the answer is yes. So I think we're confident in our model, and now what we're trying to do is convince people to actually use a mouse model to actually do things like screening for drugs and so on that may affect the outcome of that tumor.
Well, you know, the more that you can bring information with respect to the drug target and move that forward and give confidence that that is truly the drug target that could be used to develop a drug, brings us closer to the threshold of doing the drug development. Drug development is engineering. It's not science. It's what we do here at my company. And we know what the target is. So we lower the threshold of entry into pharmacology. And it's all based on a mouse knockout. So without your work, I wouldn't have a job. And I wouldn't have the opportunity to try and save 1 million lives a year based on the target that we're working on. And I can see that the Nobel Committee got it right, and that the technology that you developed, while being it's a cornerstone to modern medicine, but that the real fun part is using it.
That's right. And I think what I'm hoping is, you know, I'll be able to work another 30, 40 years and be able to be continually to contribute to this ever-increasing body of knowledge. I mean, one of the things that's really nice about science is it is a real community, and it's a community that doesn't have any borders. Good science can be done in any country, and then we build upon whatever other people have built on, and then we can hopefully extend it, and then other people will build on our contributions. And that brings essentially a community that's, you know, it's unprecedented in any other venture. I mean, I think science truly can talk across borders in a ways that isn't possible in any other sphere.
Well, one of the great aspects of being a scientist is that you live without borders. I'm Canadian. I'm working in the United States. We have people from all around the world here, and so I would encourage people to go into science if they love to experience life in a different country and possibly bring that home or introduce new ideas to countries that, you know, that exchange of ideas. Well, you know, it's been an incredible honor to have you on the show. And I thank you for the work that you've done, because as I said, it's enabled me to do my work, and the work for the next entire generation of life scientists are going to, you know, are counting on the technology that you've developed and its ability to dissect the human genome. So thank you very much for coming on.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
We were talking to Mario Capecchi, distinguished professor of human genetics and biology at the University of Utah and investigator with the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. And he is the Nobel laureate from 2007 for his work, a Nobel laureate in physiology or medicine, for the discoveries and principles for introducing specific gene modifications in mice and the use of embryonic stem cells. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Yep.
I'd also like to thank Lauren Stitzer and Ryan, who's helping out in Utah, and for helping set up the production. I'd also like to thank John Slanina for handling the audio and video boards and recording today and coming in early, because it's very early on the West Coast. I'd also like to thank the team that made this possible: Leo Laporte, Dane Golan, Eric Lanigan, Tony Wang, Frederic Louis, and the rest of the team in Petaluma, California. And I thank you, Leo, for being patient. I know we used your studio at an awkward time, and I really appreciate your patience. And lastly, I'd like to thank Phil Peltier and Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltier.